Imagine you are out in the outback of Australia on a long road at a bus stop with another person, and there was half an hour before the bus came, and this person said, "Look, tell it to me straight, mate. Tell me about chemistry. All you know about chemistry. You can start now." Now, either that man's mad or woman's mad, or they just want to see how you can go. This is Peter Hill Explains, where we have a conversation about science and hopefully advance my ability to explain things and your interest to search things up. Now, what's been happening with me is I've been slowly rehabbing. That's cognitively getting the actual information, the speaking skills, the ability to go off the cuff and discuss things. And I was realizing that as I'm getting things together, I can actually do a podcast and broadcast it relatively quickly. I'll eventually can imagine writing software to automatically attach music to it and organize it and cut some time down. But there's no point doing that until you've actually got it down to a fine art. So I'm aiming for about 4 podcasts a day, and I was going to build up a series, but I realized that I was learning so fast that the podcast that I was giving out only a few days was so old that I couldn't actually use them as feedback, so I just produced them and put them out here. But also there's other things, is that as I explained, things got better and better. There was sort of roots going down to explain various things, I would say, over and over. In quantum mechanics, there's no surfaces. There's no such thing as a surface in quantum mechanics. And various other things I was just putting across. And then as I put out different podcasts, I'd say, oh, look, people are rather interested in this concept of electron affinity. This is something that when you try and explain it to other teachers, they go, throw things at you. And they don't quite literally throw things at you, but they say, look, is it in the syllabus? Look, I'm not interested. I said, look, it's the other half of what you're teaching. You know, one half just doesn't make sense, but of course that doesn't go. But when you actually podcast out there, you see, oh, look, people are actually interested in some of the aspects. And you know, like me, they're struggling away and stuff like that. And so what I thought is that I'm building up my skill on certain topics, building up my skill in sort of reading something to get the flow and the turn of the phrase out and being able to think and speak at the same time. Building up my skill in terms of just the ordering of your chutes to get the overall idea. Just to order it again, you get a general fluffy introduction, an introduction again which says it's a podcast, you're going to do something like that. And then you give a general lecture so they know what it's about, the general lecture. Then you hit them with a formula so they can stop and use the formula, because they want the formula sitting in their memory so they've stored it, studied it ahead. So you don't want to be halfway through and introduce a formula out of thin air. Then you read the question itself and then you have a go at answering it. And what in general is I still trip up. I still don't hit all those juicy marks ready to go. I still trip up. But in general, I can hit it a lot more professionally, or a lot more ideas on it. So in this case, what we're looking at is, can I explain all the concepts of chemistry without getting too much, too historical or too deep? So let's go. All our physical world, pretty much everything we pick up and touch, can be explained by chemicals from the periodic table. At one level, it can be explained by the actual physical chemicals from the periodic table. On another level, it can be explained by those chemicals changing the number of electrons they have, so they give and take some electrons. And on another level, it can be explained by those electrons moving, either in response to light as a dye, or conduction, or metals, or things like that. So there's different levels, but it goes right back down to the periodic table. So the idea that everything in our existence is made out of 92, 108, depends how you do, I think it's 92 stable elements. I'll just check that, but I won't go. It's up there, number of stable elements that you'll normally come across. And those elements are the basic building blocks. And really, just as an aside, that if you've got one uranium atom, which is made up of electrons, protons, and neutrons, and you've got another one made up of the exact same protons, electrons, and neutrons, they are identical. Like, you can't mark one. They are actually identical, and you could actually set them up so that they're entangled. That's a pretty amazing idea, that part of an entangled stuff, you can't tell the difference between. So I've gone too deep already. And so you've got these basic components which are made 13.8 billion years ago in something which is smaller than an atom, expanded to the size of a pea, and in that blink of an eye, or less than a blink of an eye, blink of a photon, so to speak. It's not even a blink because it's faster than the speed of light. It inflated that tiny little pea to mini, mini sub proton size. I'm not going to say electrons have a size because I'm going to really tease you with that later on. When it expands to something physical, that birth. Is that very first thing of the universe. Now, I'm not going to get too much on that because that's more physics, so you want to do more chemistry. But the universe began, well, initially with quarks and leptons, and these are the basic things which were made up, protons and neutrons and electrons all formed together. It made hydrogen, and then very, very quickly, within 12 minutes, I'm told, I read one paper, 12 minutes, it's probably different. It was so dense it actually fused a huge amount of energy, and actually went along, and nearly half of it, like over 50% of it, went into helium. Now let's work this out because this is worthwhile. Hydrogen is a proton. Deuterium is a proton and a neutron. Now remember that a proton and a neutron is deuterium. And it doesn't last anywhere in the universe. Any time it enters a star, or even in Jupiter, it gets used up in fusion. It's like easy chew. And I'm only saying that is because any deuterium you have today, and it's heavy water today, is not being made in a star. There's no star making deuterium. Deuterium is made in that first couple of minutes in the Big Bang, and after that, no more deuterium has been made in the universe. It's just this stunning, stunning stuff. Like, when I pick up a rock, I say that's 13, sorry, that's 4.5 billion years old at maximum before it came across. But if I hold some heavy water in my hand, I know I'm holding something which was made in the first minutes of the Big Bang. And in the first minutes of the Big Bang, more than half the mass went into helium. Helium's got 4 units, right? So what I want you to do is pick up four, hold up 4 fingers on one hand, and on the other hand, hold up 3 fingers. So that's 7 fingers, all in all. I want you to close the 4 fingers on the left hand and leave the 3 fingers up, and you can count. That's one group of four, two, three. Roughly 75% of the universe is still hydrogen, but less than half the mass of the universe is hydrogen. Most of the mass of the universe is helium. And on that side, it's protons and neutrons. That's an interesting thing. And that starts to get us into the story of how these elements are made. And let's talk about it. The elements, when helium gets burnt, it actually burns and burns and burns and makes anything up to iron. You get these stars, which are basically these beautiful rings of different elements. That's the elements at different points burn away. Now, it burns very hot, very quick, and these carbon stars and hydrogen stars and silicon stars are out there. They're burning out there, and we can see it being made. And then something fantastic happens. I can't believe I'm talking like this way. Then something very happened. There is this unstable detonation of a star. That is, the pressure wave, it kicks up fusion. The fusion pushes the wave. The wave starts the fusion, and you get a runaway thing. So you can imagine it's like an avalanche, an internal avalanche. And this compresses the star and compresses all the elements together. Neutrons fly everywhere. And in this neutron-rich environment, we produce something like only 2% of the mass of things above iron. Is that the iron is such a huge amount. The rest of it is the other elements. And they're the entire elements which we've collected together in this mystical table called the periodic table. And it's, let's give you a quick guide to elements in the periodic table. Each element in the periodic table, as it advances one, it gets a number. And that number is the Z number. The Z number is the number of protons. The number of protons gives you how stable the shape of electrons, because the protons and the neutrons stick together with a force, a fantastic force called strong nuclear force. It pulls them in tight, pulls them in small. And we're going to have to start to talk about the Schrodinger wave equation. Schrodinger wave equation is something which talks about the fabric of matter in space. And it has this beautiful take-home idea. And as I've said, there ain't any surfaces in quantum mechanics. Things glide into existence and glide out of existence. In fact, most things can exist through each other in quantum mechanics. And that is that as I pick out each electron from a atom, that electron is more or less the size of that atom. So it's incredible. Say if you had a suitcase and uranium's got 92 protons, it will have 92 electrons. And so if you had a suitcase and you have this really fluffy stuff and it's the size of the suitcase, and you can fill that entire suitcase with each block of fluff, but the fluff is not compressible fluff, it's magic fluff, which is ghost fluff, which can go through each other. Is that imagination? No, it's not. It's reality. And this is one of these things which just really grips you. People say, oh, quantum mechanics is too hard. I want reality. Well, look, reality is quantum mechanics, and it's the ability of things to travel through each other. They're waves. They can travel through each other in space. The light things are big. So the proton and the neutrons are really small, and they hold on to each other through the strong nuclear force. This is the quarks exchanging between each other. So you could say the proton turns into the neutron and the neutron turns into the proton all really quickly, and they actually all exist through each other in space in a potential. There's no sudden repulsive force in the very center pushing them apart. They actually exist through them in space. So your helium, a hydrogen, which is a single proton, you can imagine that, and you could well imagine perhaps, it's fuzzy, it goes from a certain range, and we can actually measure that by the actual scattering of it. And when we say scattering, we say, we measure the radius at which there's 50% of the proton inside that radius and 50% of the proton outside that radius. That's not what I call normally a radius. So say if you've got a footy, mate, you've got a footy, and you say, well, what's the radius of that footy? You actually measure it from side to side. You can measure it. But this way, when you measure quantum mechanical objects, you actually measure the 50% ratio. So what happens is you say if it was a solid, you'd cut it down, shave it down until it was 50% of the mass was shaved and 50% was still inside it. That's pretty hair-raising. But helium's even more hair-raising, because helium, each proton is on top of each other and each neutron is on top of each other. How can it? Well, a neutron can actually slide through a proton, and the proton, if it's spin up and spin down, that's starting from that very instance of the Big Bang, the universe split basically into two S2 symmetries. Spin up and spin down can actually sit on top of each other. You don't believe it? Well, all supercomputer simulations of objects use spin up, spin down, sitting through each other in space. You don't like it? Well, you really hate it. Well, you're not going to be able to do any advanced chemistry, any supercomputer simulations. You won't really understand spin up, spin down. If you don't like it, you won't be able to see how neutrons can actually travel through ordinary matter. So if I was to throw a neutron at you and you put your hand up to catch it, it would fly through your hand, and if you open your mouth, go, it would fly into your mouth and out your throat and out and into a wall. Walls made of concrete, it would then slow down perhaps and bind with concrete and emit a little X-ray, gamma ray, when it combined with the individual protons in the wall, the wet, moist wall. So wet concrete can actually slow down neutrons, absorb neutrons. However, that sets up into deuterium, made a little skerrick of lithium, and just looking at those little aftermaths, the little things saying it's made this much helium, just almost no deuterium, just a fraction of deuterium which we have around today, and it's made just a little smidgen of lithium, just an even smaller smidgen of beryllium, we can actually look that up and say, uh-huh, and people far smarter than you and I, unfortunately, said, look, it's lasted, that's last 16 minutes into the Big Bang and so forth. And then they've looked up at the sky and they've converted, so we can actually see the Big Bang. You can see the Big Bang. If you see the Big Bang, if you look at night, the black of the sky is not really black. It's the faintest red. It's the blackest red you could possibly think. It's not a red that you can see. It's a microwave red. And if we look at that, and we can look at that red, and we can sample it and do it, we can actually listen to that red. And you know your graphic equalizer, your old thing where you can see the different frequencies. You can see something called, it's not the actual frequency of the light, but the spatial frequency. It's amazing. But we can look at the bumps along there and say, yep, that's caused by this, that's so much, you can pull out so much information from the Big Bang. But let's get back, we're onto our periodic table, and there's 92 elements, so to speak, up to, well, 92 is just uranium, obviously, there's going to be about 82 stable elements coming up there, because up to uranium, it starts to be a bit unstable after bismuth, it becomes a bit unstable. Getting along, going up. But each of those elements are all arranged, and the number of protons determine the nature of that element. So all elements have the same number of protons, but they may have slightly different number of neutrons. Neutrons are the glue, and there's a bit of slack. You can have a few more, a few less. It's still there. If you have a lot more, it's unstable. If you've got a lot less, it's unstable. You can generally hit a sweet spot. But depending how those elements are sorted, depends if you pick up a piece of, say, iron, I can actually then look at that piece of iron and tell you what planet it came from. How can I do it? I look at the number of neutrons that are in each atom and sort it out. In fact, that actually tells you the relative atomic mass is the average for number of neutrons in, effectively, average number of neutrons in that sample. So, indeed, I can actually, in some cases, pick up where what continent a piece of metal came from, because it varies ever so slightly from continent to continent. So we can actually spot, say, lithium battery made from South American lithium, or Chinese lithium, or even Australian lithium. So the relative atomic mass is RAM, for American, relative American mass of things. I'm sure it's not like that. So we've got these things, the Z number, the A, the RAM is a effective thing that I measure on a set of scales. So it's the mass related in a certain way to grams. In fact, the RAM is the mass of something in grams, but it's the same amount, if it's the same number of atoms in grams. So the same amount of atoms of hydrogen, if I had the same, that replaced each hydrogen with a helium, I'd get hello. For those who believed I was actually out in the middle of the Australian bush at a bus stop with a poor person I was telling about chemistry before the bus arrived, I have to disappoint you. The in reality, I had to pop inside and get the dinner on for all my kids as we're going along. But we're up to the point of discussing the periodic table and the fact that you've got protons, number of protons. This is positive charges in the center is the Z number, and that gives you the atomic number. So carbon, for instance, is atomic number 6, neon's atomic number 10, oxygen's atomic number 8. That's the number of protons. And the number of neutrons is a variable feast. And the number of neutrons that you pick up naturally is reflected in a RAM. You mix there, so you get a different RAM for Mars, Earth, even different continents. Depends what's how the ore deposit's been made up or the process which has been made up. For the most famous nuclear thing is the atomic mass number. Slightly different. It's the physical number of protons and neutrons. So 235 is the bomb uranium, the reactor uranium. 238 is your garden variety uranium, which is as boring as anything. It's barely radioactive, this uranium. Of course, you can change all that, but I promised to talk about chemistry. So chemistry had a fairly interesting birth, but discussing about it too much will get you too confused. People are confused, concerned about adding two dissimilar materials and getting another one completely different. So they were absolutely convinced that the actual nature of materials were bound up in the actual particles, and it moved forward. So you get an interesting reaction, for instance, with a water absorber, calcium chloride, and baking powder. You mix those two together, and you produce, sodium chloride, which is salt, and calcium carbonate, and a bit of carbon dioxide as well. You mix it together, and you get chalk out of it. So this really did people's heads in here. What's going on here? But we now have a basic thing. We say you mix two chemicals together, you get a chemical reaction. And there's two sort of things which are very similar but different. And people don't really make much of it. But the idea is that in a chemical reaction, I'm not going to go into the history of who said what. In a chemical reaction, you come up with a pile of chemicals and they're a pile of atoms and they're grouped together. In one side, you chemically react it, and on the other side, they're regrouped. They're the same atoms on either side, but they're regrouped. Now, what that is, that pile of atoms being regrouped, the same you can count them, is to say that matter is neither created nor destroyed in a chemical reaction. Strange thing, matter is actually being destroyed in the sun and converted into energy, but in a chemical reaction it's not changed. Now, it really goes back to what is matter. Now, matter is a shopping list of particles. It's so the matter in a hydrogen balloon is different from the matter in a helium balloon because the actual particles are different. But matter, as described in the first part of the chemical reaction, is simply the shopping list of atoms that you have there. So you can say ingredients, a recipe makes something. The actual still ingredients are inside. They're not changed. So there's one aspect that matter is conserved in a chemical reaction. So the number of particles on one side of the chemical reaction, the actual number of hydrogens, chlorines, oxygens, you have a shopping list of there, and then you do the same order on the other side. The matter order on either side of a chemical reaction is the same. That's one thing. There's another thing which is a little bit more complex. It says the mass is not changed in a chemical reactor because each matter has its own specifically piece of mass. Ergo, therefore, the mass is not changed in a chemical reaction. So that's really getting into chemistry. Then you've got these things of what goes with what, the fundamental thing. And a chemical reaction is the mass hasn't changed, but who's got the electrons at the end, the actual position of electrons changed in the chemical reaction. So the actual matter and mass doesn't change, but there's a rearrangement of what atom goes with what and what electrons go with what. So you can have a sort of a very basic chemical reaction, which is, say, very simple, the dissolving of sodium chloride. Now, the chemical reaction is such, is defined as such that I can expect to see the same matter on either side and the same mass on either side. However, it's a little bit different. Sodium chloride crystal, we write, for the sake of the purposes, oh, let's not say a sodium chloride crystal. Let's say I've got a lump of sodium and chlorine gas, and I burn the two together. Now, what's happened, when I burn the two, sodium loses a chlorine, loses an electron, and chlorine gains an electron. And therein lies the nitty-gritty of getting to, if we can actually look at the energy of losing and gaining an electron, we can actually get to the energy of a chemical reaction. That's a pretty, you know, pretty amazing thing to think of. So the energy required to lose an electron is called the ionization energy. So if it's got a complete number of equal number of neutrons and protons, that's a neutron accretion, protons and electrons, it's happy, it's at a low energy state. If I remove it, so it's if I, it's sort of like if I, magnets are sticking together, I pull the magnet away, it always takes energy to move it around. And that's a fairly easy concept to understand, that if I've got so many electrons, they should balance the number of protons on the inside, the charges are balanced, and it takes a certain amount of energy. So it's always a positive amount of energy to remove an electron. It's a large amount of energy for helium, but it's a small amount of energy to do so for francium up the other end of the periodic table. If you look at that end, it's called the ionization energy. But there is something which is more freaky, and it's so freaky that people have decided not to teach it. And this is one of the things that coming in as a scientist, and then just working it out for yourself, and then I suppose having your various heart things, reworking out for yourself again, you tell it as it is. And this is the other mystery. The opposite of ionization energy is electron affinity. That is the energy gained by adding an electron to a perfectly neutral atom. That is electron affinity. So go on to your dynamic periodic table, go through all the properties, click ionization energy, click electron affinity. And when you look at it, the periodic table will look like you've never seen it before. One of the most amazing things is that every atom is either indifferent or likes an extra electron. Even metals like having an extra electron. And this is hard to think. Something neutral is happy with an electron sticking to it. And the answer is that something neutral is actually positive from a particular direction in which an electron approaches it. And so it's overall neutral from a distance, but as you walk up really close to it, you can look in and see a positive aspect of an atom. Or it may not appear positive at all, except when you get really inside it, you can actually push an electron through it. And so F minus it's got the greatest electron affinity. That is, you release a huge amount of energy when you add an electron to it. So this is the amazing thing of chemistry. This is why chemistry works. It's the electron affinity and the ionization energy. When you add those two together, they add up with a release of energy. This is why sodium and chlorine, when you burn the two together, sodium, it takes energy to rip that sodium off, but the electron gained by the chlorine is so much in it. So you've got these two aspects. This is ionization energy, but you have to also understand electron affinity, which is the opposite side. So have a look at it. And there's another thing called electronegativity. When you've made it together, the electron will be will not be completely given over to one or the other. It will spend more time on one than the other. So that's electronegativity. And again, that's going to be added through. There's more sophisticated stuff in it as well. But that's the basis of the chemistry. Yeah, this is the rearrangement of matter and the release of energy based on the ionization and electron affinity. That's the real basics of it. And then the actual, I suppose, energy in the actual shape and storing of what you've made. And so there's a lot more to it. And look, I'll go in and talk about entropy, but that's the very basic thing to do, is that you look at your periodic table. There's one set for ionization, one set of energy for electron affinity, and that's basically, if you look at the chemical reaction as matter is a rearrangement of matter, but electrons are exchanged between particles of matter. That's the key. That's the second thing. And the electron exchange can be accounted for in these two things. One is losing electrons, ionization energy, you have to pay for it. Gaining electrons is an energy positive thing. It's the most amazing counterintuitive thing, that's electron affinity. I think the bus is coming along. G'day. Goodbye. G'day, mate. Goodbye. Get on your bus and go off and think, do, and teach science.